Feeling bogged down by your daily grind? Not living up to your greatest potential? Then it's time to turn up the heat and get real with what truly matters, be it family, career, wellness, spirituality, or anything else that fuels your inner flame. Join Fire It Up with CJ as this respected life coach talks to a wide range of experts and everyday people for their inspiring and unconventional ideas to help you make the most from your life. Equal parts heart warmer, cheerleader, and butt kicker, CJ Liu draws on her extensive experience in business and life coaching, along with her intuition and playful humor, to address meaningful topics with truth and irreverence. It takes just one spark to ignite a fire. Now, here's your host, CJ.
Welcome to the Fire It Up with CJ show. I am CJ Liu, and this is a show on the Transformation Talk Radio Network. And today, we are talking about innovations in education, and we are really lucky to have Jeff Edmondson, who I think is probably the busiest person on earth that I've ever met. Jeff, is that true?
I don't know. I'm sure there's others. There's everybody in this world is busy, is what I've learned, just in their own way.
So Jeff is the manager director of Strive Network, and it's a national organization that is really committed to helping children succeed from birth to college and later into meaningful career. So it's one of the few programs that it's the only program that I know of that spans that huge range. So welcome, Jeff. Thank you for Jeff's water heater is broken, so he's just going through Calamity Central. So thank you for being on the show. It's crazy,
no
Dave.
My pleasure.
So tell us about Strive Network and the kind of populations that you serve.
Well, essentially what Strive is about is it's not really a program so much as an initiative or a way of a community can organize itself to think differently about how they serve children over the long term. Essentially, just a bit on my background, I was in the Peace Corps, so I learned about the government sector a good bit. I was then in the public school in Washington, D.C., where I acted as a resource coordinator in the largest high school in the district. And then I worked for a nonprofit for a while in D.C. that worked on school facilities issues. And then I worked at a foundation. And essentially what I took away from those experiences was that any of the those individual sectors working in isolation are not really going to see the population level impact that we all desire. We see the headlines all the time about how our schools may need to perform better, or how kids in early childhood are not necessarily prepared, or in higher ed we're not getting enough graduates. And really what we need to think about is, okay, so if those are the results we're getting, the way we're doing business right now must not be working. I call it the 1,000 points of light theory that really I think we've proven doesn't work, right?
What doesn't work about those ways?
Well, if you think about it, 1,000 points of light, where we just, we have resources all over the place, and we hope that a kid, particularly kids who are in need, will be able to find those resources independently, or that their family or that their extended family will be able to help them navigate all these different resources that are available to them. The truth is especially for families in poverty and those that really need the most assistance, that's not going to happen. What we need to do is think about how we could reorganize those community resources so that they'd be just part of a child's education. Essentially saying that, the schoolhouse alone, working from 8 o'clock to 2:30, isn't really what encompasses a child's education. It's all the experiences they have from the home to the schoolhouse to after school programs, and so forth. And so the question really becomes, how could a community reorganize all those resources to make sure that they're right at the fingertips of the kids who really need them? They're right there. And how could we do that differently? And so essentially what happened in Cincinnati, in northern Kentucky, for those who don't know about Cincinnati, it's kind of a two-state city. We're right on the Ohio River, and the urban core of the region is the city of Cincinnati, but also the cities of Newport and Covington. And there were a core group of community leaders that got together, and the group kept growing because they were thinking about, in the era of globalization, when the book The World is Flat came out, we need to compete not just with Indiana, but we need to compete with India as well. There was all that going on. There was a sense from funders in our community, both public and private, that there wasn't really a return on investment for all the dollars that we were putting into children. And then really there was this pinnacle moment where the coroner of our community on the Hamilton County or Cincinnati side stood up in a meeting with about 100 of his executive-level peers and said, listen, folks, we may be, you know, thinking about trying to get more college grads. He said, you know, right now we are program-rich. We are system-poor. And, you know, not only are we going to not see more college grads, we're going to see more dead kids on my tables unless we figure out a way to become system-rich.
What does that mean? I don't get that. So it's program rich versus systems poor. What does that mean in that context?
I think it goes back to what I was saying. It's his idea that if we were to start one more program that somehow was going to get more kids in college, we weren't going to succeed. We have plenty of programs. We have plenty of resources focused on children. The problem is that, number one, they're not organized. Number two, we don't really have the data to know what works. And number three, it's completely random whether or not kids are going to find them. And so our job as a community should be to take all those different resources that exist for kids, whether they're the social services that our government invests in, or whether the nonprofits that the philanthropic sector invests in, and say, how could we really begin to reorganize all that to become system rich?
Okay, got it. So how do you actually add all of those different pieces? So let's give us an example of what that may look like if we were to, you know, just because I think people don't know exactly all the different programs that you may be referring to, people who are new to this area. Well, tell us all the different programs that you mean.
Well, so essentially we've worked now not just in Cincinnati but in about 10 other communities across the country to build what we're calling the civic infrastructure. And essentially, it's not a new concept. I'm sure that many of your listeners have heard of this concept back in the war on poverty and at other points in our history to say, really what we need is a different way to organize ourselves to have greater impact. And so what we found consistently across all these sites is that there's four key things that a community would need to do in order to build that civic infrastructure effectively. Number one is a shared community vision so that you really get people to aspire to something different than what they may have experienced themselves, right? So if you think about most of the time when I do that word association game where you toss out a word and you say, what was the first thing that popped in your head? When I say education, 90% of the time, everybody in the room thinks school. So in our community, we literally build a visual that says education isn't just about the schoolhouse. Learning starts at birth. It goes through some form of college. There's both the academic benchmarks kids need to hit, but there's also the social-emotional benchmarks. And the community, meaning all the key sectors, education, business, nonprofit, philanthropic, they have to wrap their minds around that vision and really own it, right? That's the first step to trying to build this civic infrastructure. The second piece is then evidence-based decision-making, which would be if we as a community, any community, were to say that we're really serving children differently, what would be the outcomes that we would just say have to move, right? So it could be kindergarten literacy. It could be third grade reading. It could be eighth grade math. It could be high school graduation rates. It could be having a strong adult role model. Whatever it is, whatever those outcomes are, could we not just say we're going to zero in on those outcomes and not expect the school system alone per se, but all of us in the community are going to hold ourselves accountable for getting results. And we're going to focus our energies. For example, in Cincinnati, they said early childhood is the number one area we need to focus on right now, as well as college access. So we as a community are not going to forget about those other areas, but we're going to focus our energies right now on those areas where we're just seeing the worst outcomes. And as a result, this community, all the partners that are involved, have really put forth their time and energy to see improvement in those areas, and you're starting to see the dial move.
In the third
area would be collaborative action. So this is where it gets down to the ground, and I'll use early childhood as an example. Where in every community you have Head Start programs, pretty much, or you have nonprofit preschool providers, and the public schools provide preschool, or there's private preschools. The United Way in our community really brought all those players together, and they all agreed that the one thing they were going to try to move was kindergarten literacy. And then they looked at the data, and all of them saw that there were certain things, such as having a certified teacher in a preschool classroom, or having a nurse work with the most high-risk mothers. Those practices really move the dial.
Right. So I get just
in,
Oops, sorry, just to recap, because we have only 30 seconds to go, but here's what I'm hearing as the recap is that really what you're doing and your program is all about being systems rich, so that there's a system that the community agrees on that will help support the child from birth and beyond. And we're going to find out more about that in the second segment. So let's hold on. We'll be right back. Many thanks to Jeff. And next we'll be talking why it takes a village to educate a child, and we'll continue our dialogue on this. So please listen to segment two of our four-part series on the innovations in education. A big thanks to you, Jeff, the managing director of the Strive Network. Remember, if you missed part of the show or want to hear more, then look us up on iTunes or at FiredUpWithCJ.com. Thanks for tuning in.
TalkRadio.com, transforming the world one listener at a time.
Do you know how to achieve wellness in all areas of your life? Hi, I'm Mary Jane Mack. Signs of wellness are a capacity to love and ability to nurture, a sense of purpose, a good sense of humor and plenty of fun in your life, a concern for others and a respect for the environment, a conscious commitment to personal excellence, a sense of balance and integrated lifestyle, and capacity to cope with whatever life presents. Well, people enjoy their lives and want them to last as long as possible. That's why the wellness mindset usually accompanies other constructive, healthy lifestyle habits. By adopting a wellness mindset and behaviors like eating well, taking the right nutrition for the body, exercising, and saying affirmations are just a few things to structure a healthy system of values and beliefs. I will be your wellness coach to help you achieve a wellness lifestyle. Call us at 888-777-4232. That's 888-777-4232. And visit us at MaryJaneMack.com.
If you've gone through a separation and feel disappointment, despair, loss of identity, and fear, there is a new pathway to joy for you. SoulWorks Coaching empowers you to go through this separation with soul and hope. So get ready to step into a new relationship with yourself and build a fabulous new life. Contact Monique today at 617-328-7113. That's 617-328-7113. And visit soulworkscoaching.com. Give yourself this gift of love today.
Hi, I'm Paul Bland. Did you know there is only one truly perfect food protein produced by nature? It can bring dramatic results to your health, your appearance, and overall performance. Introducing Action Whey. No other protein supplement on the market has been able to achieve the incredible health benefits of Action Whey while still achieving a taste that is better than a malt shop shake. Action Whey, for the way nature intended. Visit seaandearth.com. That's seaandearth.com for more information.
Hey, Mary, I haven't seen you in so long. You look so different. What happened to your glasses? Did you have surgery?
Whoa.
I never noticed how blue your eyes are.
No, I didn't have surgery, and I don't have to wear glasses anymore. I searched the internet, and I found a website. It's called BetterEyesightNow.com. It is the best thing I have ever done. There's a program called Regaining Your Vision Naturally. And, oh, by the way, it helps reduce stress. You should check it out. And you might be able to get rid of your glasses. Go to BetterEyesightNow.com.
Hi, everybody. Thanks for listening to Fired Up with CJ Show on the Transformation Talk Radio Network and listening to our four-part series on innovative approaches to education. Today, we have Jeff Edmondson, who is the managing director of Strive Network, a national organization that is working with entire communities to reform education in specific communities. And he's worked with everyone from service providers, government agencies, and business leaders to generate and sustain innovation in education. Welcome, Jeff.
great to be here.
So tell us, what led you to develop your current approach in working via communities and using that method?
Well, the first piece was this realization that we as a community were program rich and system poor, saying that, we have all these different programs in the community and we haven't really knit them together so the kids that are most in need could access them. Mm-hmm. But the second piece was to say, could we stop pointing our fingers at each other to say, it's Head Start's fault, or it's the school system's fault, or it's so-and-so's fault, and say, listen, we all own a piece of this. And so there was a sort of transformative moment in Cincinnati when you had all these key community leaders from different sectors come together, and everybody was saying, well, we got to fix this, we got to fix that. And the president at that time of the University of Cincinnati was a woman named Nancy Zimper. And she stood up and she said, listen, everybody thinks the school system's got their issues. Everybody thinks there's all these problems. I, at my institution, have a 48% retention rate for students from their freshman year of college to their sophomore year. She said, that's on me. I have to fix that. But the bottom line is if all of us in this community were to work together with the resources we have, we would have a much greater chance of me turning that around. So she said, could the nonprofits that are focused on college access and retention really work with me arm in arm? Could the school systems that prepare the kids work with me arm in arms? Could we bring all these different players together to really take a different kind of approach? And I think that was one of those key moments that got everybody really engaged.
Hmm. And what was the reaction? Was it, yeah, let's do it? And then, those are things where I've been in meetings like that where it's like, yes, let's do it. And then you get into meetings and it's just a total nightmare trying to get everyone to agree on stuff. Was it like that in Cincinnati? How did you create a positive experience for everyone to work together arm in arm?
Well, there were certainly some of those meetings that everybody was pretty much determined to make them different, make this different. And what we learned was that the reason that a lot of those previous efforts in the past in Cincinnati, and I'm sure a lot of the listeners have experienced those, is because whenever we start these conversations, we always talk about what are we going to do about it, right? What's going to be our first action step? When in reality, the first thing we need to talk about is what are the outcomes that we actually want to move? What are the things that we want to see change? Because if we don't have a way to measure whether or not we're having success, over time, everybody's just going to start going back to exactly the same thing they were doing because nobody's going to be able to hold each other accountable for anything. Mm-hmm. So the big step in our community was to say, okay, if we were to hold ourselves accountable for something, what would it be? And everybody threw up 100-plus some indicators. Everybody had their own indicator. And we went through a process to say, there's got to be 10. There's got to be 10 that we can just commit to. And you can imagine it was all, there were all these different things. But when you really thought about it, what would be the 10 we wanted to move? And we narrowed it down. And now whenever we come together, we don't just talk about this, that, and the other. We talk about those outcomes and what is happening. And that brings people around the table.
So give me an example of some of those, it sounds like how you boiled it down. It just sounds like it was arm wrestling match or no. So I assumed it was.
This is very tactical, but it's so critical, is you actually get the experts in related to data together in your community. And most of the time, these are the people we bring in at the end to evaluate what we've done. What if you actually brought them in at the beginning, right? And you said, what would be those metrics we could actually collect? And they can tell you, because everybody may want to measure this, that, and the other. But the fact is, it's not very easy. Right, to measure a lot of these different things. So what would be the actual measures? And those folks can tell you.
Mm. So then they actually looked at those lists and said, can't measure, these 50 we can measure. And then is that how,
exactly.
And that's a really good point, because that's such a good point, because I think a lot of nonprofit works, you work on stuff that's intangible, like someone's happiness. I mean, how do you measure that?
How do you measure that consistently over time? And how do you really put your finger on it? And so they came up with a set of criteria that said, it ought to be measurable. It ought to be something that we have at hand. It ought to be something that we can measure consistently. It ought to be something that the public would trust.
So right? Give me an example, one out of the 10 or a few, just so I can kind of wrap my arms around what they are.
Well, I mean, in most communities do not have a consistent metric for early childhood education, right? Real metrics don't really start until first grade. So in our community, we essentially said, we may want to measure health. We may want to measure wellness. We may want to do this, that, and the other. But the one metric that we could track consistently was something called the crawl, which was something that everybody had already adopted. So why don't we use that assessment, because it's at our fingertips, and it actually tells us what we want to know.
Huh, you mean whether a child is crawling or not, or what? What is...
Oh, no, no, that's it stands for something, K-R-A-L, but it's actually a literacy assessment, the kindergarten readiness assessment and literacy. And so it's actually an assessment of, you know, before a kid enters kindergarten, where are they when it comes to the phonics and other areas? And so it essentially gives people a very real idea of whether or not, you know, in a child's early years, they are ready to learn. And if they're not now, our community can say, okay, for those kids that aren't, how are we going to organize all the nonprofit resources, all the public resources, to make sure that those kids that really need it have access to not just what we think works, but what the data says actually does work for kids?
And how can the data make the correlation between, okay, some after-school program that does X is actually going to affect the literacy crawl rate or whatever the numbers that you collected?
Well, it's really hard, right? Because in the social sector, we always want to say that there's so many different variables that we can't possibly measure something. But that may be the case. But in this work, we're saying that we don't, you know, even in business, you don't have to have numbers that are perfect. One of our lines is don't let perfect be the enemy of good. Mm-hmm. Having data is better than not having it, especially if we're not necessarily using it just to beat people up, which is the way we usually use data.
Right.
We're actually trying to use data to improve how we serve children, right? Our other line is don't just use data to prove things, use data to improve things. And so one of the biggest barriers was how do we actually get people comfortable with saying, you know, I may actually not have very good data, but I can use that data now to do what I do better. And that in our sector is something very hard to swallow. But if we don't begin to think in those terms, we're going to keep throwing resources at problems and not really understand whether or not we're having impact.
Okay, so I'm putting on my, in Washington State, there's the WASL, which is a standardized test that all schools are now focused on. So they have they have an agreed upon metric in which everyone must hit certain WASL scores in order to get funding. And so as a result, all the schools spend all their times focusing on numbers. And the criticism from teachers are, hey, if you do that, then you're taking away, you know, all these wonderful, you know, you're just focusing people to achieve test results, to achieve the numbers, and you're missing kind of the softer side of education. Do you think that that's true in your programs too, or your initiative as well?
I think that can be a concern, but what we found is if you put out the data and then you challenge the community to say, great, if there's other metrics that we need, let's develop them, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I'll go back to early childhood again. Initially, we were just measuring literacy of a child. There was a coalition of providers called the Coalition for Resilient Young Children. They came together and actually developed a social-emotional measure for understanding how kids are progressing developmentally as opposed to just cognitively. So, so you have to challenge yourself to say, fine, if we're worried about the softer side of learning, how are we going to measure it? And so those teachers or those community members that are concerned about that, our challenge to them from a STRIVE perspective would be we have to have a way to understand whether or not we're making progress. So can you help us in developing those?
Right. So in the case of Washington State, you would say to the teachers, you know, prove to me that the children are getting a less than education or because of your, you know, a lot of the teachers complain because they have to teach towards the test versus the creative approaches that they typically use with teaching. So they would have, you would go back and say, well, prove to me that your approach actually will result in higher scores. Is that okay?
And you would say to them, listen, there are the business community and nationally would agree with you, right? They hire for things like creative thinking or the ability to work collaboratively. And you have groups. There's a group called New Tech, the New Tech Network, that's actually developing metrics for how to assess cognitive thinking. So my challenge would be, let's go try those. Right. Let's put those into operations so that we could actually understand how we're doing against those metrics and whether or not they're actually accessible. And then we can use that data to improve what we're doing as well. And so I think there's very few people that would disagree with that point. The challenge is how do we actually not just talk about it, but measure it?
Yeah, so a lot of your stuff is data-oriented, which I think has pros and cons, but I think that the interesting thing I think also is that nowadays, like the organization that you mentioned, a lot of the stuff that we view as intuitive or soft skills can be measurable, and it's just a matter of figuring out the right data to ask. So
Exactly. And essentially what you have is is a movement building to say, you know, don't worry about having data just to beat people up. And I can, my wife's a teacher, I can sympathize that, you know, the standardized tests are used to beat people up. Think about figuring out the right metrics so that we can all use it to improve and work together better. And if we take that mentality, it's a different way of approaching it.
Okay, we have one more minute, so I want to ask you, you know, since you've been working with these 27 communities, I mean, what are usually the objections that people have in working this way?
I mean, the biggest one is that, you know, how is this going to impact me? Because rightfully so, people have concerns, especially in this economic climate, about their funding sources.
Right.
So the biggest issue is going to be, how do you actually get people to see that, you know, there really is enough work to do that we could all have a role to play? It just might be that by looking at the data, we need to stop assuming that what we're doing is working and maybe think about doing things a little bit differently so that we know we're having impact.
Right. Interesting. Yeah, it's an interesting point. And I think that's what we actually have had an environmental initiative in Seattle or in the state of Washington with a bunch of environmental groups. And the biggest fear is, well, what am I going to get funding for if, in fact, we agree on three initiatives? And what does that mean for all the other nonprofits? So I think that is, that's a valid question. And I guess, you know, there's also a valid response to say, well, maybe you shouldn't be working on it. Like, you know,
exactly.
There's only three things that you can push. Anyways, I know that's kind of a hardcore position.
It's some of the hard discussions that eventually, when we don't have as much money as we've had at times, we're going to have some of those.
You're going to have to move one time or another, right? So anyways, We have to wrap up this segment. So thank you again, Jeff Edmondson, Manager and Director of Strive Network. Stay tuned to find out more on innovative approaches to education. In the next segment, we also talk about data and getting more information on what works and doesn't work in terms of Jeff's actual experience working with communities. If you miss any part of the show, look us up later by going to iTunes or at fireitupwithcj.com. We'll be right back.
Feeling bogged down by your daily grind? Not living up to your greatest potential? Then it's time to turn up the heat and get real with what truly matters, be it family, career, wellness, spirituality, or anything else that fuels your inner flame. Join Fire It Up with CJ as this respected life coach talks to a wide range of experts and everyday people for their inspiring and unconventional ideas to help you make the most from your life. Equal parts heart warmer, cheerleader, and butt kicker, CJ Liu draws on her extensive experience in business and life coaching, along with her intuition and playful humor, to address meaningful topics with truth and irreverence. It takes just one spark to ignite a fire. For dates and showtimes, visit www.fireitupwithcj.com or www.transformationtalkradio.com.
We are living in a time of great challenges and greater opportunity for transformation. The good news is that public awareness of the need for change is also growing exponentially. More than ever, your transformative message is needed to empower millions across the globe.
Hi, I'm Dr. Pat, host of The Dr. Pat Show, and I'm excited about announcing an unprecedented opportunity for growth as we expand our broadcast by launching Transformation Talk Radio and the Transformation Network. Join me and a team of amazing people and host your own show on Transformation Talk Radio. Get ready to expand your horizons, tap into the best listeners anywhere, and join one of the most positive and expansive networks today.
Historically, there came a time when the boundary of water was transcended as man developed the boat, and the barriers of water became freeways. Join Dr. Pat as she launches this exciting venture. To host a show, call 1-800-930-2819 or email host@transformationtalkradio.com.
Ocean's Flavor natural sea salts are specialty products with less sodium, up to 68% than standard table salt, free of any chemicals or artificial flavors. Ocean's Flavor natural sea salts maintain 84 necessary minerals for a balanced diet and healthy body. All Ocean's Flavor natural sea salts may be purchased at oceansflavor.com. And now, Ocean's Flavor natural less sodium sea salts has introduced heart healthy gourmet seasoning at 68% less sodium than table salt. Available in Mexican, Italian, garlic, seasoned, Asian, barbecue, Cajun, and Chipotle flavors. The sodium is the lowest of any seasonings on the market today. Purchase heart-healthy gourmet seasonings on the web at oceansflavor.com and in many national grocery chains. Oceansflavor.com, the only salt company that produces 100% natural, low-sodium sea salt.
Naturopathic doctor, founder of the Martha's Vineyard Holistic Retreat, and author of the New York Times bestseller, 21 Pounds in 21 Days, Dr. Ronnie DeLuce has helped tens of thousands of people, including celebrities and athletes, with her message of lifestyle change. Now Dr. Ronnie DeLuce wants to help you. You too can be saved. Email Dr. Ronnie DeLuce at info@ronniedeluceonradio.com and visit mvholisticretreat.com. Dr. Ronnie DeLuce, your partner in wellness.
CJ Liu, and you're listening to the Fired Up with CJ show on the Transformation Talk Radio Network. Today I have Jeff Edmondson, who is the managing director of Strive Network, a national organization that is working with 27 states in developing a more holistic and systematic approach to addressing education. Welcome, Jeff.
Thanks. Great to be here.
So tell us overall what some of your top goals are with this program or this initiative that you're working with.
Well, essentially, we're trying to take a cradle-to-career approach to education. So we're essentially asking communities to identify what are the outcomes that they as a community would want to move across the entire learning journey of a child from cradle to career. And so there's five outcomes that communities have really agreed on are all critical. So kindergarten readiness, third grade reading, eighth grade math, high school graduation, and college completion of some sort of certificate and associates or bachelor's. So we're essentially saying to communities, how could you begin to work collectively to see those outcomes continuously improve over time? How could you make sure that instead of seeing the spikes that we often see in education of this going up and then 1 year going down and then going back up and then going down, how could you really focus all of your energy to see those outcomes and maybe some others that you also think are important in your given community to see them consistently improve? And so our work is to really drive communities to invest in what works so that those outcomes will not go up and down over time, but constantly in the right direction.
Okay, so repeat those goals again. So kindergarten readiness, third grade reading, you said?
Third grade reading. I don't know if you've heard, there's stats that say that they estimate prison populations by third grade reading rates. So that seems to be the one that folks seem see as really critical. And then eighth grade math, high school graduation, and then kindergarten, or then college completion, or of some sort of degree or certification.
And why the eighth grade math?
Well, there's definitely nationally a movement around STEM, the science, technology, engineering, and math fields, to say that these outcomes are really important. But beyond that, there was some research that came out almost 10 years ago now, maybe even more, called the Algebra Project, that essentially looked at students and what kind of progress they're making in algebra by eighth grade, and that was also a predictor of long-term success. And so that's another area where we really just need to see growth, especially in the knowledge economy, where those fields of those STEM fields are critical.
And so you could focus as late as eighth grade and still turn things around by the graduation time, is that, or the same thing with reading, that you could wait until those years, or that's when you have to start measuring to figure out when. Are those just like the two metrics? Like if you don't know by eighth grade and third grade, then you're kind of messed up, or why?
It's never too late. But the fact of the matter is that these outcomes do build on each other. So really, it starts with kindergarten readiness, right? There, we know 90% of brain development happens by third grade, or by age three. I'm sorry, 90% of brain development occurs by age three, and so we know that if a kid goes into kindergarten way behind. Already they're behind the eight ball, and so
right.
You know, really then third grade reading is another key gateway, and then eighth grade math another, and so they build on each other, and you can always turn somebody around without a doubt, but it definitely becomes harder and harder over time if you don't see these metrics continuously improving at an individual child level, but also at a community level.
Okay. So tell us a little bit about the other insights that you've gained from, you know, focusing on these four goals, which is great because then you have like four things everyone can focus on. And so are these the same goals across 27 communities, or are they?
That's what we're actually working to build. So it's hard to get consensus, but we did have a recent convening actually in Portland, Oregon, where we had 83 different communities that are interested in in building this civic infrastructure. And we asked this exact question, what would be those metrics? And that's how we landed on these five. But what's really exciting is what you learn about moving these metrics, right? And so I can just give you an example in one area in Cincinnati. Over 10 years ago, an initiative started with the help of KnowledgeWorks, which is the organization I'm actually based at, where the community placed resource coordinators in the schools to coordinate resources to have greater impact. There was actually a woman named Darlene Kamine here in town who has just done a phenomenal job in setting that up. And now the district has taken it and has really embraced this concept. And we now created this data system where you can have the academic data, but all the social service data piled into one place. And based on that, they now know that when kids have a certain kind of tutoring, right, when they have a tutor that's trained, that works with the kid at least once a week for an hour, and they're very present within the school, that those kids actually do much better than kids that don't. And so now all the tutoring programs that already exist can say, all right, listen, I need to learn from that. I may be doing tutoring one way, but for a certain type of population, doing tutoring this way really, really works. How could I rethink about what I'm doing so that I'm actually I'm doing this kind of support that really gets results for kids? And so all down the pipeline now, we have seen that existing efforts in the community that people may not even have known about get uncovered and have results, and those are the kind of things that a community needs to rally around and do more of.
Wait, so I may make sure I understand. So resource item, I'm not sure what a resource coordinator does, but I assume that what they do is they look across both social services and resources needed for the kids, tutoring and education post, you know, after school. Is that what a resource coordinator does?
Essentially that's it. They're placed in a school, and they what we've made sure of is that they would have data on an individual child. So every kid in that school building, they have the data that says this is how they're performing academically, this is maybe the behavioral issues or so forth. And then they can look not just at the school resources, but also the community resources in order to make sure that they're having greater impact.
Yeah, and I think I saw something on your website just to make it concrete for listeners. So let's say that, you know, I actually have a certain reading disability and it's making it hard for me to go through the school, and my mom works and has three jobs and can't take me to the tutoring that I need. So the resource coordinator, as I understand it, would say, hey, here's the thing. You can actually go to the Boys and Girls Clubs. They have a place for you to hang out near the school. You know, the teacher will be able to walk you there 5 minutes from the school after class so that you have a place. And then you return back for your tutoring, and we have a good resource for you. So it's someone thinking through, you know, a working mom, you know, three kids, four buses to get to the kid. How are you actually going to help that kid get through the food, education, you know, child care services? Is that the right idea with this resource?
Exactly right. And it gets back to that original concept of program rich and system poor, is that if you don't have that person that's actually helping to make sure the kid knows where that stuff is and is organized, then you have difficulty. I think back when we first started Strive, we met with a bunch of community groups, and there were two grandmothers actually who had children in the public school system where we were, and one of them said, you know, without a doubt, this particular program, if it had not existed, my kid would not be going to college. And there was a grandmother sitting right next to her who happened to live right down the street from her that said, if I had known that, my kids wouldn't be on the street. And the point was, you know, unless somebody happens to stumble upon something or meet the right person, they may not even know that things right around the corner exist. And so as a community, building the civic infrastructure is about making sure that people have ready access, not just to programs, but programs that really work.
Right. Right. Well, and so here's what I'm hearing you say, that part of what you do is you're a screening resource, too, to say, like, you know what, you need child aftercare, you know, services after school so that your child has a safe place to be. Here are six different options, you know, three of which are close to you. We would recommend this based on what we know, based on the data that we have about your child and a reading thing, because this program has a special reading, blah, blah, blah. Like, is that right? So you're kind of offering suggestions as well as resources.
So I would say that that's what the Community Learning Center resource coordinator does at the school level, right? They help to broker that for an individual family. So Darlene and her team at the Community Learning Centers Institute, they've really figured that out at the school level. And what Strive is doing is more at a community level, right? To say across all these different activities that are happening. You know, it looks like resource coordination really works. So a funder might come to Strive and say, I really want to invest in kids. What do you think would work? Well, we would recommend that they take a very close look at these resource coordinators if they want to move third grade reading. If they want to move early childhood outcomes, we'd say, listen, go talk to the United Way. They're the ones that are coordinating all that work. But they know right now that having a certified teacher matters. So making sure, you know, if you want to invest in certification of preschool teachers, that have make a huge difference. Or there's another program called Books in Action that we know that if kids are a part of Books in Action before their kindergarten experience, those kids come in on target. And so at the community level, we're really starting to help funders, both public and private, start to think about what they might want to steer their resources towards.
Right, because you actually have data. It's like, hey, you know what? We've actually known that there's a correlation between, you know, the crawl literacy test and books in action. We can actually see, is that what you're doing when you actually can see that there's a correlation?
I can imagine that some of your listeners may find this to be a little bit provocative, but if you think about it, in the private marketplace, any of your listeners who have a stock market portfolio, they have advisors, right? They have people that they would go to say, what would be the best way to invest so that I actually get a return? Unfortunately, in the social service community, we don't really have anything like that, right? That's why we have this 1,000 points of light, because everybody that has a good idea can start a program that may not really have impact on a child. Mm-hmm. So by creating the civic infrastructure, having a central place where you have all the experts in a community that work with kids, you have the teachers' unions, you have the school district leadership, you have the heads of the universities and the heads of the major philanthropies, they're actually looking at the data together. And they can all say, you know, over time, we really do have a better understanding about what gets results for kids. We really could say, this is a better investment than that is right now. And while that's a hard conversation to have, if we want to see the dial move and see real improvement, we have to be willing to have those tough conversations.
Yeah, I'm in complete, wholehearted agreement. And I want you to work on the environmental movement next.
Well, I can tell you what's actually interesting, and I don't know if people, in the Stanford Social Innovation Review, there was an article on Strive that came out called Collective Impact in the winter of 2011, and it really has gone viral, and it's gotten a lot of people's attention, and it highlights efforts to do this work, not just in the education realm, but in other realms as well, including the environment, and we have been contacted by people all over the globe, believe it or not, who are interested in this work, and they're interested related to homelessness or related to the environment or also public health and safety. We're finding people are very interested in that area as well. And so this idea of marshaling community resources in a much more productive way has really got a lot of momentum.
Hallelujah. I'm glad. I'm glad to hear, having worked with a lot of nonprofits.
In the end, it isn't about the adults, right? In the end, it is not about the adults that are doing the work. It should be about us figuring out how to marshal these resources to better serve kids.
Exactly.
And that is our biggest challenge.
I hear you. Hallelujah, like I said before. Thank you so much. I'm just thrilled to hear about your success and the process itself, and I think it's fascinating. So stay tuned with us to find out more about Jeff Edmondson on our four-part look on innovations in education. The next segment will be looking more about investments at work for education. Remember to tune in later. You can go to iTunes or at fireitupwithcj.com.
Radio, radio. Tell me what I wanna know. I've been wide awake, staying up all night, waiting for a song that will make me.
Are you at a crossroads? Feeling stuck? I'm Karen Hager, the Fog City Psychic. My gift is helping people who are in transition receive spirit-led guidance about their next steps. I offer private sessions via phone or Skype, intuitive development classes, and much more. Please visit my website, fogcitypsychic.com, to find out how I can help you move out of the fog.
Hi, this is CJ Liu, and this is the Fired Up with CJ show on the Transformation Talk Radio Network. And today I have Jeff Edmondson. We've been talking about innovations that are happening in education and working on education using a systematic approach. And in the last segment, we were talking about thinking about education from an investment standpoint. So welcome back, Jeff.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
So how do communities or individuals think about investing in education now?
Well, I mean, the historical way has typically been that somebody will go out and they may, you know, do a little research on their own and maybe talk to a friend, and they'll end up putting the resources behind something that feels good. And essentially what's starting to happen here is that people are asking, if we've identified five outcomes we want to move as a community, kindergarten readiness, third grade reading, eighth grade math, and so forth, if we really want to move those outcomes, how is what you're doing connecting to those outcomes? And that begins to shift the dialogue. It makes people think less about charity and more about investment when they're giving dollars away. They're saying, I don't just want to feel good about where these dollars are going. I actually want to see impact. And that really, that's a dramatic change in perspective. And we have a few examples of how that has played out.
Yeah, let's hear them.
All right. So I think the best is the United Way of Greater Cincinnati, which happens to be just an incredibly innovative United Way nationally. And they essentially said very early on that early childhood, kindergarten readiness, was going to be one of those metrics that they really wanted to move. Mm-hmm. And so they were really the pioneers to say, okay, we're going to look at the data. We know that it may not be perfect. We know it may not be great. We may have even invested in some things that did not work, but we're going to be brave enough to look at the data and see what really gets impacted. And mm-hmm. they brought together all the different early childhood providers so they themselves could look at it rather than it being some draconian thing that people feel like is being brought down on them. And so they had Head Start in the room. They had the public preschool in the room. They had the nonprofits. And they looked at the data, and they found out certain things really worked, right? I mentioned this before in another segment of early. You have certified teachers. You have these certain programs. And what they were able to do is take $8 million that they had raised and really begin to focus most of those dollars on these practices that really got results. And then they also focused on a few innovative things, but not as much as maybe they would have in the past, because they said, we got to put our dollars behind what works. And as a result of what the United Way has done, you've seen a 9% increase in kindergarten readiness over the last 4 years, which is pretty dramatic given where this field had been going. Mm-hmm. So they literally took a pool of dollars. They could have just gone everywhere and said, we're going to target it. And that's the kind of behavior we're really looking to see and change. We had another example where you had some public dollars that for years had been going to the youth employment area and really had not been getting any results at all. And a coalition came together that we facilitated. They looked at the data. They knew that certain things worked in order to get kids really meaningful summer youth opportunities. And they took those dollars and they put them into what that network said got results, so that they were wasting less public dollars. And those are the kind of things that really, I think, begin to get the flywheel turning and help start people to start investing in different ways.
Well, if you look at investment managers, generally what they do is they have a portfolio approach in which they actually look at risk and return. And so if you're literally going to use a model like that, how does one figure out the composition so in the case of United Way, where they actually pulled all their providers and anyone involved in early education, and they looked at the programs and they looked at the teachers and all this stuff. How did they ultimately decide how to split their, and then you said there's innovation. How did they split that $8 million? How did they decide how to divvy up that money?
I mean, I think the key here is, and you brought up investment managers, one of the things we have to say to communities, you have to invest in the staff to help you make these decisions. So KnowledgeWorks, which is actually a foundation that I work for, they actually said, we will invest in Jeff. We'll invest in the person to be this, essentially a cat herder, to try to organize all these different community resources to begin to look at data in a different way. And they invested in a data analyst, somebody who can really break down the data and somebody that people would trust so that when I would go out and talk with folks, I had reputable data in hand, right? Mm-hmm. And then they would invest in a facilitator, somebody that would work with the United Way in this case, to help them begin to think differently about it. And so, you know, in that specific example, I was able to work with them to try to talk with some of their donors. The data analyst was able to provide them with the data that they may that they needed in order to have some of these tough conversations. And then they worked with their volunteers to really have a discussion about how to invest differently. But every foundation is different. United Way deals with a lot of volunteer leaders. You also have family foundations that may just be family members. And so the key is really building the relationships with those folks. So when they're thinking about making a grant, an investment, as I would say, in children, that they have the data at their fingertips. And KnowledgeWorks essentially said, we will make sure to get you that data as long as over time we really do begin to see resources flow in a different direction.
Right. So in some ways, there's two things in order to have this approach. Like you said, you need somewhat of an infrastructure, the data analyst, the community organizer, the facilitator, to kind of have these group conversations and agree that the data is sound or that those are the right metrics or all those different kinds of things. But then how did you decide, you know, so when you were in this group in United Way, you had $8 million, you had to split it into certain pockets. Like, how did you figure out what the right combination of money is? Like, okay, $4 million to the certified teacher programs, another $3 million to programs, you know, $1 million to innovative stuff. Like, how did you split it out? I mean, because you're looking at risk and return, right? That's what an investment manager does.
Well, and this is where this is a little bit differently, right? And it does differ from the for-profit sector. In the for-profit sector, you might just hire one or two or three people to work together to try to make recommendations to you. Right. And typically in the social sector, what happens is you have a funder that would put out a request for proposals, an RFP, to say, this is what we think will work. And that then drives action. This is a little bit different in that United Way pulled together all these providers, and the providers themselves looked at the data and made the recommendation to fund.
Oh, in terms of how much to invest? Whoa.
In terms of how much to invest where. Now, don't get me wrong. This takes a lot of time and a lot of trust building. I'm not acting like this is, you know, some magic wand thing. This is really difficult. But the key is going to be is that the providers have to drive the change, not the funders from on high. And that really, really does change the discussion.
Oh, my God. Okay, how long did it take? Years? I mean, how long did it take?
It took a long, long time, and we made lots of mistakes, right? And I can tell you that to this day, there's things that keep me up at night that I wish we'd done differently that would have caused a lot less heartache in town. Mm-hmm. But we got there, and now what we've taken is all these lessons, and we're working with the other communities to make sure that they don't make those same mistakes. So you've seen in Milwaukee, you've seen in Portland, Oregon, that is making leaps and bounds in progress much faster than we ever did.
Okay, let's talk about Oregon. I'm insanely curious. Okay, to come up with this community vision and then come up with this community investment plan, you know, from start to finish in a new community who's benefited from all your learning, how long does it take?
I wish I could say it takes exactly, you know, a year.
Oh, yeah,
you can't say that, right? Even because every community's got different assets in place. There may be a community that has a strong history of collaboration. There may be all these different factors at play. They may already have a report card that says these are the outcomes we want to move.
Right.
But in Portland, for example, in Oregon, you had a very long discussion about who would anchor the work. That took up to 8 months. But now that they finally figured that out, they've been moving expeditiously to get to the point where they have agreement on these outcomes. Now they've identified the areas where they're going to focus their energy because they know what kind of criteria to set up. They know what kind of conversations to have. And they, you know, the initiative in Portland is called All Hands Raised. It's a phenomenal effort led by a guy named Dan Ryan, and it's definitely worth checking out.
So how many months has it been since that? And so it's been like a year or so?
Since they figured out who they wanted the backbone to be, it's been about 6 months since they've really been on the ground getting the work done. And they have a level of agreement that you could have never been able to imagine
I'm shocked. Actually, 14 months may for some people sound like a long time, but if you've ever worked with nonprofits, government agencies, in the span that you're talking about, that's phenomenally fast, honestly.
Yeah, and it's really encouraging. And you know, ironically, this economy works into this plan because there aren't dollars to throw around everywhere.
Yeah,
so people are really starting to think about how could we organize ourselves in order to get more return.
You are a brave, brave man to even contemplate this idea. I am just thrilled and amazed to hear that it's going so well and that it's been so successful. I mean, 14 months. I mean, and I know that, like you said, there, you know, your community may differ. A bunch of disclaimers. But
it's important to say that it's not one person that makes this happen. It's all these community partners, and really having a few key community partners step up and say, I'm going to stop looking for the silver bullet. And I'm going to start looking for that long-term solution that can really get us results. And in every one of these communities, Portland, Milwaukee, and the others, you're really beginning to see those leaders step up. And that's what's really needed in order to move an agenda like this.
It's really fantastic work. So thank you so much for the vision and your hard work. And I know that it's across a bunch of other people, but I'll thank you. Because I can thank you.
All right. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it. And it's been an honor to have this opportunity to work with so many communities.
Yeah, and thank you so much for everyone listening out there. A big thanks for folks out there for your listening support and time, and much gratitude to you, WBLQ, and tune in next Thursday, and we will get into the holiday spirit with our conversation with Rogany Michaels about generosity. Thanks so much.
You've been listening to Fire It Up with CJ. Tune in each week on Transformation Talk Radio at 1 a.m. Pacific Time, 4 p.m. Eastern Time for more of Fire It Up with CJ. It takes just one spark to ignite a fire. For dates and showtimes, visit www.fireitupwithcj.com or www.transformationtalkradio.com.